This is Len Bertin reading The War on Waste Innovation, Chapter 3, Part 3. I'm going to be reading about my two favorite subjects, the 80-20 rule and 567 rule. The 80-20 rule. This is probably the most important tool in business. We know from this rule that 80% of your problems come from 20% of your customers. 80% of your revenue comes from 20% of your customers, and so forth. As you look at the data, you hope that the same 20% of the customers that create all your problems are not the same 20% that generate all your revenue. When I first started doing this consulting over 25 years ago, consulting friends told me that the 80-20 rule was a sacred tool of a consultant. Actually, what he meant was the 80-20 rule helped guide the solutions of more problems in business than any other, and in the hands of a consultant, it was a sacred tool for making money. It has always been there for me to steady a project. As far as I am concerned, however, it is and always was there to help guide my thinking. It is not just reserved for the exclusive use of consultants. It is a tool for everyone. As a facilitator, whenever I get stuck on a problem, I think almost first thoughts on a problem are, how can the 80-20 rule help me? I have some good examples, but let me tell you a story of how I first learned about the 80-20 rule. My father owned a laundry business. When I was in high school and college, I used to do the maintenance for him, and I often needed to spend money to fix things. Whenever I went to my father to ask for $100, like for a tool, he would give me $20 and see what I could do. If I needed $500, he gave me $100. Being somewhat analytical, I put two and two together and figured out that every time I asked for any amount of money, my dad always gave me 20% of the requested amount. And it always turned out that he never got quite the 100% he wanted, but he got about 80% of the desired result. I never really got to fix things right. I was always putting Band-Aids on problems, but I was keeping the laundry running. Years later, I asked him if he knew that he was invoking the 80-20 rule. He didn't, and he didn't have a clue. He asked, "What's that?" I told him, and boy, did he laugh. He laughed and then said, "You know, you didn't know that I was such a great intuitive understanding of business, did you?" he said. And then I had to laugh. Let me give you some other examples. On my first consulting job as an independent, I was working with four shop workers in a manufacturing plant. The president of the company gave us an assignment. He told us to figure out something that would make him a lot of money. In other words, identify a problem and propose a solution. So we began to figure out what problem we were going to work on. We began by asking what products accounted for significant revenues. After asking that question, one of the workers immediately had an idea. He knew that there was one model of the product that accounted for 25% of sales, and it had a 20-week backlog. That backlog accounted for 80% of the company's total backlog. In this case, we had found 20% of the business, actually 25, that accounted for 80% of the backlog that was 6 weeks or more. After we completed the development of a cell to deal with this product line, we reduced the backlog to 2 weeks in a very short time, and the product ended up generating about 40% of the business and over 60% of the company profits. In summary, the story illustrates how we were able to identify an opportunity using the 80-20 rule and with good data to direct our confidence that the problem was worth doing. We then came up with a great solution that paid great dividends to the company. Another application of the 80-20 rule occurs quite often when employees get into the war on waste. I ask them to identify a problem, but I don't give them unlimited budgets to solve the problem. We ask employees to five problems that amount to $100,000 of annual waste. When we impose a spending limit of less than $2,000, we force employees to think creatively. By putting that restriction on employees as they work through the war on waste, you force them to understand the value of scaling down a problem to deal with only 20% of the problem and see how much of the benefit you can achieve. For example, a team finds that the waste of setups accounts for about $1.5 million in lost revenue. A great solution might be adding a pallet changer to speed up the time for setups at a cost of $25,000. I go back to the employees and say, I can't give you $25,000, but I can give you $5,000. In other words, I'm going to give you 20% of the total cost that you need. Now see what you can do for me with that. In most cases, the 80% of the benefit is achieved. 80% of the business is achieved by spending 20% of the expected cost. And $1.2 million of benefit, 80%, might be achieved with a manual pallet changing system that costs $4,000. One of the interesting that happens during the war on waste is that the 80-20 rule guides project teams to pick low-hanging fruit. In other words, spend only as much as you need to make a dent in the waste. Sometimes the waste is so big that it is like eating an elephant, and how do you do that? A bite at a time. Our war on waste projects usually amount to small bites out of the total company waste. And when we target only $100,000 of annual waste that can be fixed for less than $2,000, we're getting employees to focus on those items that have the biggest bang for the buck. So when a company tries to do automation projects after the war on waste, it is hard to justify the automation investment based on minor inefficiency improvements. The automation project is usually a capital investment. It means spending money to change the way a company does business and who its customers might become. The automation project that goes in after the war on waste is usually strategic in nature. In these capital expenditures, we try to find investments that improve revenue per product employee. This keeps the focus on productivity. But it also drives the decisions to look at the inefficiency or efficiencies of processes and the hourly rate per employee needed to maintain the new equipment. I mention this because years ago, when I first started consulting, I did work in SIM, Computer Integrated Manufacturing Systems. The way we got the early stage funding was to show the dramatic improvement in business processes that resulted from the automation. In fact, the automation was actually a multiple-stage process. We called the first phase, Phase Zero, and it was a different version of the war on waste. It targeted process inefficiencies. We then argued to our clients that these quick fixes were really good because they generated cash quickly. The cash was then used to pay for the subsequent automation phases that consisted of preliminary technical specification, prototype development, implementation testing, to test whether the prototype worked, full project specification and implementation, testing, and measurements determining the project's success. When we were all done with our SIM projects, they resembled our work with a war on waste. We target a waste. We use the 80-20 rule to guide us in partitioning the waste down to a small problem that could be implemented with a $2,000 allowance. Once the waste was eliminated and the measurements told us so, we then looked at automation opportunities. We've used the 80-20 rule to help us in banks. 80% of the loan cycle time was consumed by 20% of the loan steps. In distribution companies, 80% of the total items picked in a warehouse came from 20% of the items. This is a helpful concept in laying out the design of a warehouse. Materials management, MRP systems are based almost entirely on the 80-20 rule. Pay attention to the 20% of the items that count for 80% of your inventory value. The 80-20 rule applies everywhere, and it is good to know what it means. The 567 rule. The 567 rule is a subset of the 20-80 rule or 80-20 rule. We discovered it during the war on waste. We were always in a hurry to get projects completed, and we didn't have time to look at 20% of the problem demanded by the 80-20 rule. But we did have time to look at 5% of the problem. And when we did, we kept seeing that we were getting about 60 to 70% of the target benefit. We called it the 567 rule without really knowing much about it. It just seemed to work, but it didn't make sense until we stepped back and looked at what was happening. It turns out that what we were seeing was effectively the 20-80 rule applied to the 20-80 rule. If you take 20% of 20, you get 4%, and if you take 80% of 80, you get 64. And the 464, 4% and the 64% were close enough to 5 and 67, and that is how we got there. We think that 567 is the way you should run a business. For instance, when you develop a new product, deliver 5% of the features, and you'll get 67% of the benefit, and then you can add other features over time. The rationale here is that 5% of the features gets you to the market quickly. The 5% of the features can serve as a foundation for building an aggressive product expansion plan. It gives you a jump on the competition, and you have your progressive plan of features available to quickly introduce new versions of the product. My theory on new products is that you want to get the product off the shelf quickly and immediately begin generating profits. The problem with most developments of new products is that the engineer is never satisfied until he or she has delivered the 100% solution. That is folly and is very expensive. Get the product to the market and use the profits to pay for the expansion and improvements and be recognized as an intelligent source of great innovations. Managers and executives that I've worked with need about 2 seconds to understand why there is a problem letting engineers get the 100% solution. My point is it will take forever and cost a fortune. So I advise CEOs to get the product out the door and see if anyone really likes it or wants it. Once on the market, new features can be added. Of course, you need to anticipate as many of these features as you can to minimize the cost of upgrades. But if you start generating revenue, you can start adding staff to move to a more complete offering. There are many others more knowledgeable about how to do this, but trust me, if you adopt the 567 design mentality, you'll be very successful and profitable. In fact, I have a theory based upon this principle. It is the Bertrand theory of why electronic trade shows exist. I talk about it later, but it boils down to this. If you didn't have a trade show to give an engineer a target for product completion, it would never get done. I have other theories about this, and I go into those later in this book. But all of this is based upon the 567 rule. Just get it to market and do it quickly. That's the end of part 3 of The War on Waste Innovation. The next chapter, I'll spend more time on measurement, including yes-no charts in great depth with lots of examples, and Kaizen working in America. So thank you very much for taking the time, and I'll see you next time. This is Len Bertrand. Bye-bye.